NDB Media presents Eli and Izzy in the Afternoon. To talk with the guys, dial 347-637-2306 or via Twitter at Eli and Izzy Show. Now, here are your hosts, Eli Gray and Izzy Weiss.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's Ellie and Izzy here in the afternoon. Obviously, a lot to talk about on this Tuesday afternoon. Not much in the way of actual sports. We'll probably get into that a little. But, you know, unfortunately, the topics of discussion have been the Ray Rice issue as well as recently Adrian Peterson. And that clouded this whole weekend of NFL football just when we were all looking forward to and right back in the mood of having football back. All of a sudden, you get these scandals that clouded and took away from football being back, even to the extent of week one. You know, all the stuff came out with Roger Goodell of what exactly he saw, the new suspension for Ray Rice, and right away the Thursday night game, which is usually a lot of hype, especially at the beginning of the season. And instead of it being the focus on football and football being back, what we had to focus on was the scandal with Ray Rice and the punishment that was handed out after the video, the second video came out showing exactly what Ray Rice, what exactly happened in the elevator. So instead of the two-game suspension, we got a full season-long suspension of Ray Rice, and right away the Ravens cut him. As you know, as people say, the problem with this whole thing is that it was all reactionary based on the NFL. The NFL wasn't taking any preliminary steps to get in front of this and to take steps that would show people that they're taking action. Now, the more interesting debate to me is, to what extent does the NFL have a responsibility to be the judge and jury as far as what a player deserves? Obviously, the law didn't give him a full punishment. So feel free to join in on the discussion. Our guest call in line is 347-637-2306. Once again, 347-637-2306. We'll talk all the NFL goings on, the Ray Rice scandal, the Adrian Peterson scandal, which is a lot more nuanced. Also, you have the league-wide problem, or what people are pretending is a league-wide problem, of violence. And the thing I always go back to is, very simply, it's 1,700 players in the league. You are going to have some players, some people who are not picture perfect and are not the paradigms of what you would want out of a human being, especially in a league where violence is predominant. You're asking them to spend their whole week hitting people and be violent, but all of a sudden they're going to have to separate that when it comes off from the field. You know, it's a fine line that we make these people walk for our entertainment, so you shouldn't be that shocked that sometimes the line is crossed. Now, that's not to say that all the players have these tendencies within them. Most of them are upstanding citizens, but it doesn't shock me, it doesn't surprise me at all that within a pool of 1,700 people, of human beings, that you're going to have some players who walk, you know, cross over the line big time and do things that are illegal. And it's interesting how the standard has become higher for the NFL than the law. And to me, it's bothersome that we expect more from the NFL and the other leagues, you know, baseball and basketball, than we do of the law. It's a very risky business when you let individuals in an organization be the judge and jury. And you know, that to me is the main problem with the whole thing, without even getting into what each of these individuals did and the crimes that were being punished. You know, we would not want these same standards to be held up to ourselves. If the standards, if we ourselves in our own lives did something wrong, we would not want to be judged for the rest of our lives, which is what's going to happen to Ray Rice and to Adrian Peterson. We wouldn't want to be judged based on that one act, and yet we are so easily able to do that with athletes. Why do we not expect the same? You know, for us, if we would be in that predicament, we would want the benefit of the doubt. We would want leniency to be applied. We would not want to have ourselves be judged based on that one act. And the fact that we demand it so easily of everyone else and demand other people's jobs so easily is mind-boggling. Izzy, what's your whole take on this thing?
What is my take on this thing? First of all, thank you very much for taking it in. Unfortunately, my phone died, and I had missed the first couple of minutes of the show. I presume you're talking about the Adrian Peterson situation, and it's kind of, to give a fair opinion, you have to sort of look at it from both sides, and I understand what it means to be disciplined via physical contact. Now, there are those who grew up in certain sects and certain homes where words were the way that you dealt with people. But I grew up with parents that, at least my father was from Europe, and the way that Plin was more on the physical side. So I do understand that aspect of it. I'm aware of that he used something called a switch, a tree branch. He left scars. Now, I was never left with scars or anything like that, but I've been hit with belts. I've been hit with sticks, not a tree branch, you know, obviously on a smaller scale. I've been hit, obviously, with hands. I've been left with, you know, marks and whatnot. And going to yeshiva, obviously, I mean, you can relate to this, I assume. It was a different sort of, we grew up in a different time. It was a different era 25 years ago, 20 years ago when we went to school, and yeshiva, at least, it wasn't the norm, but it was the way that they did things. It was the way that they disciplined us. And these days, it doesn't jive. The last couple of years, I know that if a teacher lifts their hand to a student, I mean, forget subject to being fired, they're subject to, you know, being prosecuted. But 20-plus years ago, back when we were growing up, that was the way that they disciplined. So I'm not going to sit over here and say, you know, Adrian Peterson's a horrible guy. He's obviously, you know, he obviously has his way of disciplining his children. But let's look at it from the era that we grew up in, which is the same that he did. I mean, I'm roughly his age. We're basically the same age. So I can totally understand the environment that he grew up in and what he, you know, as far as discipline that he had seen when he was a child. So he's just reenacting that same thing. Now, that doesn't justify it, but it explains it.
Yeah, so I think that's also, this is where a lot of people go off the rails, like you just said, is the distinction, making the distinction between a justification and an explanation. There needs to be nuance between the two, and there needs to be nuance within the whole discussion as to, it's really not as simplistic as some people are trying to make it out to be. There is a lot of things going on there that we are not used to, that, you know, you grow up in different ways, and sometimes people don't translate it the way that, you know, some people, to them, that's the way they grew up, that's the way they were taught, and that's the way they're going to act no matter what happens. So, you know, the problem also is the pictures. Once again, it's almost the same thing, you know, the Ray Rice issue. It's when you have pictures, it's just that much darker, and people feel a lot easier to demand harsher punishments. And also, you know, you have to take into account who was administering the punishment. I mean, Adrian Peterson is a brute of a guy. He's just big. So even though his intent might not have been malicious, but at the end of the day, a bigger guy like that is going to inflict more pain and more harm when you are using a switch, even if that's the sensibilities that he grew up with.
Right. 100%. That definitely does make sense. He is a big guy, 6'1", 215, whatever he is. He is a big dude, and, you know, when he swings, it's going to be painful. Now, again, like I said, there is no true justification for what he had done. I mean, a kid does something wrong. He does something wrong. You know, you discipline him. Maybe, and I don't have children, so I'm going to try to be as fair as possible. So I don't know what it means to discipline a child. Though, as a child growing up, I had been disciplined. But as I understand it, if a kid does something wrong, I mean, there's talking to him, and then, you know, there's punishments, but leaving scars on a child, hitting a kid, to that extent, there really is no justification. I can't see what a kid could possibly do at the age of 4 that could warrant that type of beating. Now, like you said, in this day and age with pictures, and you see the slash and the scars and all those things, when you put them all together, it makes obviously for a darker story. But the fact of the matter is that I sit here and I tell you straight, as somebody who grew up in a house, who grew up with teachers who were very physical, the kind of scars and the type of abuse that I, as far as the pictures that I'd seen on him, there's nothing that a 4-year-old can do. There is nothing that I can imagine a 4-year-old being capable of doing that could warrant that kind of abuse. I just think that when it comes down to it, the NFL is not an authority. The NFL is it's his employer. But when the actual authorities hit him with something, he was indicted on charges. I mean, the reality is that it's a legal matter. I feel that it's in good faith that the NFL should comply on that end. I understand they're not judge, jury, and executioner, but let's be honest. Goodell missed completely with the Ray Rice vote. He missed completely on that end. I think that activating Adrian Peterson a week in, you know, literally the guy was deactivated 1 week and he's back on the field after this. And now that it's coming out that there's possibly abuse of his second child, I feel like the NFL is striking out miserably in these things. I don't feel they're taking a harsh enough stance on very serious matters that affect everybody. This is not just, this doesn't just affect the athlete. This affects, you know, regular people. And they just seem to be making the wrong decisions every possible turn. I'm not really sure how they can really correct it at this point. But the fact of the matter is that there has to be some kind of a change in the NFL because Goodell seems to be missing the point.
Well, let's take into account also, I mean, Goodell was harsher on Ray Rice than the law was. Adrian Peterson, while he was indicted, has yet to go to trial. Why do we expect higher standards of the NFL? Why aren't these athletes entitled to the same legal system as we are that we would demand of ourselves personally if it was, yet when it's somebody in the ether, the public, we're very easy and very quick to mete out punishment when we wouldn't want it for ourselves, when we wouldn't want it for our family or friends. You know, it's very easy to jump to these conclusions, but at the end of the day, the real outrage for the Ray Rice thing should be with the law. You know, Goodell was harsher than the law, and he shot himself in the foot by coming out after the fact and making the punishment harsher. You know, granted, the video came out. The problem is they were reacting to it. They weren't taking actionary steps. And also, you know, but with Adrian Peterson, I mean, even yesterday, there were all these rumors of a second indictment, and people jumped on the story, and it turns out, no, his kid hit himself on the car seat. So we're, you know, we jump to all these conclusions, and even if it's a shaky source at best, we run all over it. We look for the worst in people, not in the best. We then define people by the one thing, their one worst action, and it's just a little bit ridiculous on how the double standard is to me of what we expect of these athletes. When, with all due respect, the league is 1,700 players wide. Yeah, I mean, in a workplace environment that was that big, you wouldn't expect every single person to not get into trouble. Yet in the NFL, we demand so much higher standards when they've so far been out ahead of this on the law. And here was another interesting point that I don't think a lot of us take into account. I was just listening to Marcellus Wiley on the Levitard show, and he made an interesting point that, you know, him being on the Players Council, he has a background, you know, into actually what happens, that the league gets all these claims on people, of people trying to scam out players and make accusations, so that we don't see even 95% of those. There's so much of it. And so when the one or two that come to the public, you know, it's not as clear cut as they should have taken action they shouldn't have. You know, there are things that need to be taken time to investigate, and we don't see a lot of that. So, you know, when teams say due process, it's very easy for us to jump out and say, oh, that's easy to say, but we don't see most of the cases that come. So there is due process that is necessary, but we don't take that into account.
You do make a good point that there are things that we do not see, and there's definitely behind the scenes matters that we are not privy to, understandably. But when it comes to the Adrian Peterson story specifically, it's the reason why I believe people jumped more onto this situation. A, because the Ray Rice thing, how that sort of fell apart. And B, more importantly, as we discussed, there were pictures present and there was no denial by him. He openly admitted to it. So when people are reading the story, they're seeing everything that's pretty clear-cut. It's Adrian Peterson not denying what had happened. It's Adrian Peterson trying to justify what happened by stating that that is how he grew up and that is the way he was taken care of. That's the way he was disciplined in Texas. So we have the pictures of him doing it. We hear his confession of it. And we hear him justifying it. So when you take those three factors into account, it's not that he's buried himself, but you can't expect people to hear that and to see everything and to not come to a conclusion that they have. I mean, let's be honest, the Ray Rice thing was a much different puppy, a much different situation. We didn't have all the information that we did on that story. We didn't have the juice of it. But I think the Adrian Peterson thing, it hits home everywhere. And the fact that those three things are out there, I believe people are fair in their judgments. I believe people are failing in their thoughts, in the way that they look at the situation, because it's out there, it's clear cut. There's no bullshit, excuse me, behind it. It's Adrian Peterson saying, yes, I did this. This is how I was disciplined when I was in Texas. I'm admitting to what I did. There was no apology either. It was just him trying to justify his actions. So I'm completely behind the people on that. The Ray Rice story obviously has many more twists and turns, but the Adrian Peterson thing is pretty clear-cut to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, like, you know, with all due respect, like, we need to just, like, get over this and focus back on what sports is. I mean, it's – and unfortunately, I think that the train's way left the station on this. But, you know, the focus should be more on the sport itself, the sports itself, and not the personal lives of these athletes. That's always bothered me. I mean, it's unfortunate that that's the reality, but, you know, the talk has – just looked on the negatives of what it is, and the positives of what sports is gets no mention. You know, the other week when the Bengals kept a player on their roster so that he could get his kid cancer treatment, you know, it was just a passing headline. You know, when in reality, what that should have been, like, a big, huge story like Ray Rice is, and Ray Rice should have been a passing headline. And that's also another problem I have with making Ray Rice such a big issue, is the more we give publicity to it, the more we put it in the headlines, the more desensitized we make ourselves to domestic abuse. It was a dastardly thing that he'd done. It was horrific. But, you know, it's mind-boggling to me that we're sitting there talking about how horrific it was, yet we're sitting there showing the video over multiple times on national TV, and you have these, you know, newscasters giving play-by-play of the video. I mean, it seems like being very preachy and not realizing that it desensitizes us to it. And to me, playing it over and over again, it's almost like the school shootings. You know, school shootings are awful, but sitting there giving the amount of press and publicity to it has been shown that that's the wrong approach to it, and yet we insist on doing it because we like negativity. We like goriness. We like fear-mongering, and it's just incredible that we keep perpetuating the worst in us and not the good in us.
Sadly, we do. We are a nation. We are a people that does enjoy the juice, I guess you could say. We do see the replay of it over and over, and it's continuous, and it gives us something to talk about. And yes, it does take away from the sport. And I got to tell you, last week and the week prior might have been it's probably the worst week the NFL's ever had in their history. There's nothing worse. It's just bad press after bad press. And we don't even hear much about the Greg Hardy thing, which was another story that was talked about but was completely overshadowed by the Ray Rice and the Adrian Peterson story. But I will say this, though. With all that being said, with all the drama with the NFL, I can happily say that my New York Giants are 0-2 and look like a team made up of garbage and duct tape. So at least I get to focus on the drama of the NFL because my team isn't giving me anything to possibly enjoy. And
Here's the thing that we do this every year, and it's another one of those things. We keep making the same mistake. Every year we go into the season making emphatic statements on who's going to be good, who's going to be bad, this and that, and the first 2-3 weeks just totally blow up most of that, and yet, I would just look into the season and say, give it till week 3 and 4 till you start making assessments on who's what, because you have teams that come out looking good in week 1 that weren't expected to be good, and everyone jumps on the gun, you know, saying, oh, look how good they're going to be this year, and then week 2 shows us that that was a mirage, and you have it on the flip side also, that teams that everyone expected to be great come out looking bad in week 1, and everyone says it's a mirage, and yet week 2 just shows that, no, you know, it's not going to be as easy or bad for certain teams as we expected, you know, and yet we still make the predictions because we love that, but, you know, it's almost next week, the week after, is when you'll finally start getting a real feel of how this season's going to look and which teams are going to be able to do what. The beauty of the first few weeks of the NFL season is you really don't have a clue. The Buffalo Bills are looking really good, and no one, you know, you never expected that. They got a big win week 1 against Chicago. Then they made the Dolphins, who looked really good against New England in week 1, look sloppy also, you know, and no one would have expected that. They tell you you're nuts going into the season, and then you have the Indianapolis Colts and the Saints, who are 0-2, and statistically we know starting off 0-2 means your season is pretty much over.
Well, the Saints are a team that even at 0-2 you're still confident they can come back and make the playoffs, but when you watch your team for a number of years, and yeah, I will agree with you, you're right, that making an assessment after 2 weeks is pretty bold and pretty idiotic generally. You don't really know what the team, how it can turn around over the next couple of weeks. But I can confidently, idiotically, theoretically say that even going into the Giants season, I wasn't high on them, and I gave them a best 7-9 record. at best, at the top of what they could possibly do, because Eli did look good this past weekend, but I honestly believe he's obviously at the end of his career. It's another year or two. I mean, if the Giants go, I don't think they will, but if they go 0-5, 0-6, there is a possibility you might see Ryan Nassib. It's possible, because then we're talking last year being his worst year, coming into this year not looking good, and just a changing of the guard, sort of, to say. Now, I love Eli. He's been with us 10 years, and I'm not going to sit here and go, oh, get rid of him, kill him, that's it, he's done, he's finished, I don't want to see him on the field anymore. You know, he's a bum. But the fact of the matter is he has been playing for us for 10 years, and at some point there does need to be a changing of the guard. And I believe the team needs an overhaul. They went out and signed a lot of guys to one-year deals, and it just I would love for them to completely revamp the team. I don't mind them going into a rebuilding phase. I can afford that, having seen them win a couple of championships over the last number of years. And I just feel like at some point you just got to look at the team and realize it's just not really working. And you got to look into possibly making changes. And if it requires personnel, that's usually where they look. I love Tom Coughlin. I think he's done a magnificent job with the Giants. But I honestly believe at this point, that barring anything insane, I believe it is his last year as the Giant head coach. And I would love to see them go out and grab Steve Spagnuolo up. I love that guy. But I'll take it for what it is. They did not look good. They looked horrendous the first game. They were so-so the second game, but they gave it up. And I'm still on my prediction of 7-9. What about your Dolphins at 1-1? Give me takeaways from week one and week two.
Well, week one, the takeaways were obvious. I mean, they came out looking good. They beat a New England team. You know, the first half they were down by 10 points going into the second half, and they just shut down the Patriots. The defensive line swarmed Brady, you know, got pressure on him, and we all know that Brady is just no good when he gets pressure on him. Not like mediocre, not passable. When teams pressure Tom Brady, he is downright awful. And the Dolphins were able to do that. And, you know, they left a lot of points on the field with three turnovers, you know, on scoring drives. And yet they were still able to win by 13, so the hopes were very high. And, you know, but then going into Buffalo, where the Dolphins have always struggled to play, I mean, they got beat handily. So, you know, you're once again back to this, well, we have no clue what this team is, because, you know, the offense that looked a lot more up-tempo and would be faster paced and a little different than what we're used to in week two, you know, reverted back to the boring old Dolphins offense that we saw in years past. So they got to correct that. They got to get that back on track to see what this team is. But the first 2 weeks really don't show you anything, because they were so polarizing, that such opposites of what the first two games were, that it's hard to really tell. I mean, you know, the Sammy Watkins made the secondary look, you know, pitiful, which, I mean, that's one player, he's going to be doing that for years to come in this league. I mean, he's just ridiculously good, and he's just getting started. But, I mean, it was frustrating to watch that game, because it could have been a turning point, and now, once again, it looks like this, you don't know what this team's going to be. Another 9-7, you know, 8-8 type season, and you know, that's mediocre at best. I mean, they needed to turn it around this year. This needed to be the year that Tannehill turned the corner. And if he doesn't, which, you know, so far, I mean, statistically, he's having a pretty good season so far, but it's just not translating onto, you know, when you're watching the game, it doesn't have that same feeling of how he's doing, and he needed to change a corner. The Dolphins need to get a feeling of them really having a good season and being something excited about. Joe Philbin needs that. You know, if Philbin goes 8-8 and doesn't make the playoffs, in all likelihood, he'll be gone, and, you know, even the general manager might be gone, even though it's his first year. So you can't have that because it'll be another turnover, which you don't want. You know, the interesting part, even if Philbin does have a good year, is, you know, the Harbaugh situation out in San Francisco, where he's not accepting the contract. We're not likely to be a free agent, a coach open on the market. And we know in the past that, you know, Ross has him. He, you know, to the extent that he put himself on the line with Sperano, flew out there and made a whole mess out of that. So that'll be interesting, even if he does have a good season. If Philbin doesn't have a good season, it'll make it all the more likely that Steven Ross will go after Harbaugh. So it's disheartening week two after a exhilarating week one is the best way to put it. So, you know, it's once again, going into week three, you know, you never know what you're going to get. And I mean, just as a whole, I think I spoke about this in the past, but I think I'm on the switching to watching the red zone all Sunday bandwagon, because football is, you know, when you have that alternative of just being able to see action, to watch the whole game is just boring. I mean, for lack of, you know, that's how incredibly spoiled we are. We're like, you know, what used to be exciting, watching every play and watching the game develop, has become boring to me, where I need you need the red zone to just have football, because you really don't miss anything with the red zone, and you're just seeing all the scoring drives.
I do love red zone. I love it. I have it, and that is my favorite thing football-related, obviously, other than watching my amazing New York Giants. But I do have good news, though, Eli. I have great news. We're sitting here as both a Giant and a Dolphin fan, but how about them Jets, baby? Look at what they did this past weekend. Classic New York Jets, a calamity.
Oh,
waiting to happen, the coach screwing up timeouts, the players screwing up timeouts, bad decisions, bad everything, complete collapse. So I like to look at the glass half full in that. Even though my team looks like crap, misery loves company, and the Jets handed the game to the Packers. What are your thoughts on your favorite AFC East team, the New York Jets?
Oh, I mean, I don't need to have any thoughts. They provided all of them for you. It's classic, where they, you know, they had the lead against the Packers, a very good team, and, you know, they managed to blow it, and not just blow it. I mean, it became a mess, and, you know, if I were a Jets fan, I'd be fuming, obviously, but on the outside, hating the Jets, I'm loving it, you know, and I'm looking forward to Dolphins Jets in New York, where I intend and plan on flying up for that game and joining the Dolphins fan club, the Dolphins club up in New York City, which I don't know if you know this, and for all Dolphins fans out there in New York, you got to know this, you got to start going up in the city in Manhattan at Slattery's Pub. Every Sunday, the Dolphins have a bar there. They have a good few hundred fans who show up, and it's an amazing experience the few times I've watched there. But they started a few years ago where Dolphins Jets, they go and buy out tickets and, you know, tailgate and go to the game. Last year, they had, I believe, over 400 tickets where they had a whole section for themselves. And if you remember, the Dolphins blew out the Jets last year up in New York. And at the end of the game, you could visibly see that section. And this year, it's even greater because they already sold out the one section and they're getting even more tickets. So anytime the Jets falter, it's awesome. When they do it in the fashion that they did, it makes it even better. And, yeah, it was just a lot of fun. Once again, we are Ellie and Izzy in the afternoon. You can get in 347-637-2306. And, yeah, baseball's winding down. Did you see that nasty injury to Stanton?
Oh, my God. I got to tell you that there are certain things that have happened in baseball over the past at least five to seven years, that I just screamed no. Now, the worst thing I'd ever witnessed baseball-related, other than Luis Gonzalez dropping a base hit over Derek Jeter's head, scoring one Craig Counsell to win the World Series. I said Craig Counsell. The worst thing I'd ever seen was Jim Joyce blowing the call on Armando Galarraga's perfect game. And I wasn't in tears, but I felt for him like I was screaming at the TV. Like I couldn't believe it. When I saw Mike Fiers throw the pitch and I saw Stanton get hit in the face, so many different things passed through my head. Now, I didn't watch it live. I heard about it and I watched it later. But you think about these nasty, ridiculous injuries of players getting hit in the head and some coming back and some not. I can go, for instance, there was Adam Greenberg, which you should definitely know about, seeing as how he had his one professional at bat for the Marlins. And as I recall, it was R.A. Dickey who pitched to him. I believe he struck out. But you think about a guy like Stanton, who is such a game changer, having an MVP-type season. He's the sole reason the Marlins are relevant at all. It just... You see him get hit like that, and you pray for him, and you pray for baseball because he's an up-and-coming star. He's got monster potential. He becomes a free agent. I mean, who knows how much money he's going to get? And now, guy's face is smashed up. You know, you don't know how long it's going to take. And it's more than the physical. When a player gets hit in the head, it's mental. There's a huge mental aspect to it where, can I get back in the box and not be worried about getting plunked? Now, let's be honest. Fiers hit him with an 88-mile-an-hour fastball, which, by Major League standards, is still below an average Major League fastball, which I believe is between 90.5 and 90.8 miles an hour, something to that effect. So it wasn't an average fastball, but let's be honest. The ball hits you in the head 88 miles an hour, you hit in the floor, it's going to hurt. I guess part of me said, thank God it wasn't Aroldis Chapman throwing his 103. Because God knows what would be worse, the baseballer's face. Just, I cringed. And I feel so bad for the guy. He's, like I said, he's having such a sick season. And you just hope that he comes back from it, dude. Obviously, he's carrying the Marlins, and he is your franchise. He is your guy. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, I mean, the major thing, and people don't realize it, I mean, with it's amazing that the Marlins were able to stay in the race as long as they did. I mean, technically they're still in it. I mean, we all know that's not realistic, but, you know, to be playing meaningful games in mid-September, which they were, you know, as of a week ago, especially after Jose Fernandez went down, even with him it would be, you know, baffling to some people to tell, you know, if you tell them the Marlins would be doing so. But without Fernandez, you know, this team played really well, and most of that was because of Stanton, you know, very solid fielder, a monster at the plate. And that, like you said, the mental aspect of it is you know, that's why it's going to be very interesting to watch how he comes back. Obviously, the likelihood of him coming back this season, even though he didn't require surgery, is very slim, especially if the, you know, if you're not in the playoff race, there's no reason to rush it. But, it'll, you know, that's really going to be the thing, the mental aspect of it, and to see, you know, that's something you cannot account for, you can't factor for. There's no teaching it, there's no, you know, and it seems like that's one of the things that as much as you talk about it, even if you would, you know, have people who discussed it, people who went through it before, you do not know how you'll react until you actually get back into that batter's box on a day-to-day basis and go through the process of taking major league pitching at the, you know, crazy speeds that it does, you know, 85, 90, 95 miles per hour. And so you can't even speculate about his response to it till he actually comes back, because it could be something as innocuous as no response and he just comes back out, you know, in spring training and everything's fine, or it could just be totally messing him up, and you know that, you know, you would hate to see that happen, but it wouldn't be a shock if that does, because you know that does change your approach and your attitude. I mean, Juan Encarnacion got hit when he was sitting in the batter's box and, you know, not sitting in the plate, and you know that messed up the rest of his career. So it's impossible to know what the reaction is going to be. It's impossible to know how it's going to play out. And, you know, we won't know that till February time when they come back and, you know, spring training is up and running. But it was an awful way to see him go down. And I wonder if it's going to translate into more players looking into wearing that piece that Jason Hayward does, which looks hideous. But in hindsight, you know, it's smart, you know. But I would doubt we see a change in that, because you know how players are, you know. I mean, I have that same reaction when I'm playing also. You know, you see that one gruesome accident and you're like, maybe I should consider, you know, taking some preventive measures. And then you're like, yeah, but that's going to be annoying and uncomfortable when I get to the plate each time, and I'd rather take the risk. So I doubt we'll see a change as far as how players approach the protective gear that they wear, but I would bet that Mike Stanton, when he gets back up there, is wearing that.
Absolutely. Players are they have their superstitions and the way that they've been doing it for so many years. It's not going to change the way everybody does it. Like you said, it's a freak accident and it happens. It doesn't happen as often as we think. Guys typically don't get hit in the head, and if they do, they don't get hit straight on in the face. They get hit in the helmet, possible concussion, things of that sort. Even then, it doesn't really change what happens. It happened to be the ball got away from him, and you know, people don't realize that. I can state that I threw in high school, I threw upwards of 85, 86, I topped out at. That was the hardest I ever threw a baseball. Now, I never hit anybody with it. I never hit anybody with a pitch of that speed. I've hit people with lower speeds. But people don't realize that when you're 60 feet away on a mound, you're not even on level ground, you're coming full forward with your entire body, you're releasing the pitch, and if the ball comes out at a weird angle, anything can happen. It's like, and it's amazing. I find it amazing that more players aren't hit by pitches. I think it's amazing, especially in the rain, if it's raining, if it's, you know, if it's drizzling, even if there's any water on the ball, anything that can cause it to slip. I'm amazed that guys aren't hitting more than they actually are, which is amazing, seeing as how the control that some of these pitchers have not to hit batters. But it is it's a job hazard, and I believe they get paid pretty damn well to get in the box and take a risk of getting hit. You told me I can make as a bench player $2.5-3 million a year, and I have to get into the box, let's say, you know, 150 times, and it's possible I might get hit 2 or 3 times on a baseball, you know, upwards of 90, 92 miles an hour. I'm pretty confident, and I'm pretty sure you'll agree with me that you'll take the beating. But it's not going to change the way players change, you know, the way they wear their helmets. It's not going to – guys aren't going to wear these crazy masks. It's just sad and unfortunate, and I mean, we can go through a guy who actually made an amazing comeback in Aroldis Chapman in spring training. Salvador Perez, the catcher of the Kansas City Royals, hit a line drive right back at him and hit him so hard he cracked his skull. He had to have staples around his head. I mean, he had surgery, so, and he's back in baseball, and not just back. I mean, he's been unbelievable. I mean, this year, I think, as far as I remember, I think 11 or 12 pitches we're over 102 miles an hour, and the rest of Major League Baseball, I think the number is zero. So, like, it's not just he's back, but he's dominating. So he came back from a gruesome injury and has been dominant. So I hope and I believe Stanton will come back. And, you know, we hope and pray that he gets back to doing what Giancarlo Stanton does, turning on a Jamie Moyer 67-mile-an-hour heater and breaking the scoreboard in left field in Miami in the Marlins Park. I mean, that's what Stanton does. And I've seen him. I saw them play against the Mets. I didn't see him hit a home run, but I will tell you, he is a hulking-looking bastard. And I do hope he comes back and continues to damage all things Mets, and eventually becomes a free agent, comes to the Yankees, where we will screw his career up like we have the past few years of all the players that have come to us.
Yeah, I without biting on that little last part, I'll let that slide for now. The interesting part that we don't take into account, like you mentioned, is the sheer freakiness of something like this. You know, while it is a gruesome injury that, you know, we're all going to remember seeing it, the statistical anomaly that it was. It was a complete fluke. I mean, if you think about the amount of pitches that are thrown each game and then extrapolate that over every team and over the amount of games that play, I mean, it's a statistical impossibility almost. It's not something to even really consider. You'd be foolish to take that into account on a day-to-day basis. You know, obviously that changes if you were the one that it happened to, although, you know, realistically, you know, empirically it shouldn't change it, but realistically, you know, emotionally it does. But for other players, like we mentioned, you know, it really isn't something to take into account because, as you mentioned, the control these players have on their pitches is really ridiculous. I mean, the same thing, to, you know, just to tangent a little bit, but like the umps and the refs, for all the flack we give them, the amount of things they get right is just ridiculous. I mean, it's over 99% of the plays that they get right. So, you know, yes, we harp on the 1% or the few percent that they get wrong, but we have to remember, you have to keep it in the proper context after events like this, that even though it was a gruesome injury, it's still out of the normal procedures of what baseball does. And it's kind of crazy. And geez, man, it seems like no one, you know, for all the interesting games that happened in the NFL this week, to get back to that, no one's talking about it. I mean, that was the end of the game last night was a very interesting end. You know, the interception by Andrew Luck, you know, for all this building up of, and granted, there should have been a PI on that play, but for all the building up that we've done of that guy, of how he's the next Aaron Rodgers on driving his team down and getting the win, I mean, he threw the pick, gave the Eagles the ball back, and they were able to drive it and milk the clock very efficiently to get the field goal for the last second. It was kind of humorous to see at the end of that game where they hit the field goal. They had gotten the timeout off, but, you know, it wasn't called right away, so the whole play streamed onto the field. They had to get everyone back off and kick it again. But there were some very interesting games that you wouldn't have expected. Kansas City made it interesting with Denver, the Bears bouncing back and getting the win over the 49ers, like we mentioned, the Jets blowing it with the Packers. So, you know, how about St. Louis having it be stuck starting a guy who's wouldn't even just snaps with a lot of teams, and yet he's the starting quarterback in week two for the St. Louis Rams and Austin Davis having to go to a third string quarterback, you know? So it's he didn't have that bad a game even. It was interesting, a close game. They won that game. They beat the Buccaneers, who go to 0-2 at home. So it was a very interesting week, even, you know, football-wise, but it's unfortunately not being talked about at all because we're all still so intent on being self-righteous about what we would have done with our kids and what the league should do about domestic violence.
Yeah, you're right. We don't took away the focus from the games, and not just the games, but also the in-game stuff, like the injuries that have transpired this past weekend. And it's just a domino effect. I mean, let's be honest. Most of us predicted, you know, Robert Griffin would get injured at some point. That's just the way his career is going to be. I mean, he can't stay on the field. He can't stay healthy. Then you look at a guy like Jamal Charles, who I have on my fantasy team. With that high ankle sprain, you look at other guys, Eric Berry, their safety. There's A.J. Green with a toe injury. I mean, these are big-name players. We're talking, you know, top-notch guys. And just going down with injuries, it's a sad thing. You know, it's a sad thing to see. And unfortunately, in a sport that's contact every play, I mean, it's going to happen. Things will happen. Guys will go down. You just have to hope that guys can step in and save the day. I'm sure a lot of people, if you want to jump over to fantasy football, how are you doing? I don't know. You mentioned, I believe, you're in at least one league this year. How are you so far? What's your record?
I am in one paid league, and do you, this I am happy I was on the winning side of this matchup, because I would have been crushed if not. The final score in my game this week, 112.08 to 111.76.
Nice. You were on the happy end of it. I know the feeling, except the opposite end of it. This week I happen to have gotten blown out. I got blown out in one league, and I destroyed in my other league. That's the thing that's such a killer. When it comes down to the end of the game, there was a game actually last night, the Colts and the Eagles, obviously. At the end of the game, the matchup was basically one guy had Nick Foles and LeSean McCoy, the other guy had Jeremy Maclin. What happens on the last touchdown? You know, Maclin catches the touchdown, so the guy's down by, are you ready for this? He was down by point, but by 0.05. You understand what that is? That's half a tenth of a point. The guy was literally, he was on the phone. We have this WhatsApp group. The guy's just writing like, kill me, kill me, kill me. He's dying. Please. If Maclin, like, I'm like, oh, don't worry, nothing will happen. They'll throw it to someone else. If Foles on the drive where they kicked the field goal, if that pass didn't go to Sproles and went to like Maclin, this guy would have lost. He ended up winning by, you know, by one, I believe 1.2 points because of the Sproles reception. But that's the thing about fantasy football. It keeps the games interesting even when our teams are done. Like if our team plays 1 p.m. Sunday, we still have reason to watch the 4 p.m. game, the Sunday night game, and even the Monday night game. So the fantasy aspect does give it that interesting factor to it, and it at least keeps football interesting. The problem is, and we've discussed this at length, is that you never want to be in a position where you're rooting for your fantasy player over your home team, and I'm pretty sure your position on that is you root for your team regardless, as do I. Fantasy is secondary to all that, but unfortunately many people do not look at it that way. There is an issue that we have yet to discuss. I know we don't have a lot of time left, so maybe we have to save this for the next show. But I'll leave that up to you. Obviously,
yeah,
it's not
I want plenty of time to go over it. So we're gonna. The interesting thing about fantasy is, I wonder if this, you know, obviously sounding like old farts now, if the next generation, you know, the kids growing up now, are going to be more inclined to root for football as a whole because of the exposure. You know, I mean, fantasy's been around for a while, you know, a long while, obviously, and, you know, but it doesn't feel like it's been as mainstream. You know, now all the sites are very optimized. It's very easy to create leagues, add players, drop players, follow everything. All the sites have fantasy tickers built in. It would be interesting to see if that, you know, makes a switch over, if people make a switch over to just being a football fan, and you see team allegiance drop a little, especially with the rising costs of going to a football game. I mean, some tickets at the big games, I mean, the minimum you can get into a game is for $400-something. I mean, I don't think I'll ever have that problem in Miami, but, you know, I would never even consider doing that for a football game, a regular season game. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And so it does take away a little bit of the motivation and drive to follow just one team, especially when you have, like you said, you've got fantasy, you've got a lot of other teams riding on it. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. And, you know, you still have, obviously, like we mentioned, some of the diehard holdout who won't play fantasy or take the approach that I take of I won't have players in my division on the team, no matter how much I have to reach for the next player. If one of those players is on the board, I won't do it. But yeah, fantasy has definitely changed the landscape of how we not only view sports, how we follow it, why we follow it, what we're interested in following. So, you know, that's also the interesting part with the whole Adrian Peterson thing. You know, a lot of the outrage wasn't even over the what happened. It was the fact that he was going to be deactivated. And you had on the flip side of that also, where some people were so outraged by what he did that they were going to drop him from their league, and Yahoo didn't let them originally. You know, so you had both polar opposites play itself out. You saw some of the practical of how fans dealt with it. Fantasy is now an interesting place to watch, how fans, you know, it's very easy to talk about being outraged about Adrian Peterson, but if you spent $300 for a buy-in for your fantasy league and had him as a first pick, let me see how quickly you drop him. Tell me you're outraged. If you're not dropping him, you can't really be that outraged.
This is true. You're right. If you're not dropping him, you cannot be that pissed. I cannot deny that. And yes, guess what, buddy? I do have Adrian Peterson in one of my two leagues. So that being said, no, I did not drop him, and no, I will never drop him. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even Yahoo flip-flopped on that, because originally they said, you know, tough nuggies, you know. We have, you know, the first round, I forget exactly how they do it, but it's either the first, second, and third, or your first and second round picks are undroppable. It also depends on the league. And they said, yeah, we're not letting it be done. And then I don't like using the word outrage, because it's not real. What we sports fans do is not real outrage. It's overcompensating almost, where I need to be so outraged about something and outrage other person. I just need to be more obnoxious and louder and show that I'm more outraged than the other person. It's not real outrage. So it was the outrage. I have to drop him from my fantasy team. When you think about the reality of that, I mean, that make, you know, like, come on. I know I just said, you know, if you're outraged and you're not dropping him, even if you were out, you know, it's a fine line to figure out what I think about that even, because why should that translate to you dropping him from your fantasy thing? It doesn't, you're not condoning what he did. You're not saying I agree with what he did. It's totally different. That's also where I think this fine line of where the standards we hold our athletes up to, it's such a gray area for me, because to me personally, I've definitely switched over the past few years where I really don't care about these players, you know, what they do in their lives, because we're watching them for the entertainment value of it. And let's not fool ourselves into thinking it's anything otherwise. Pat Riley had a great, summed it up very, very well when he said sports is the toy department of the adult world. And when we take it more seriously than that, all it is the toy department of human affairs. When we take it more seriously than that, in any way, shape, or form, more seriously than just a form of entertainment, I think we lose sight on what it actually is. And you know what? It's not even just that. If you're going to take it and make it such a big issue, then you got to focus on the positive as well as on the negative. But society as a whole, you know, we don't do that. And Izzy, it's been a pleasure, as always, spending an hour with you on this beautiful afternoon. We're wrapping it up now. Hopefully all this nonsense goes away and we can get back to focusing and talking just about the games themselves and on the nuances of the game, as opposed to the nuances of human interactions in the world as a whole with the law and the way it translates to sports. So I am looking forward to getting back on the air tomorrow with you again. It's been a pleasure, Izzy. We shall pick it up later. Adios. Have a good day.
Take it easy, folks.